He's going to talk to us about what classical mechanics of continuous variables would look like in an epistemic constraint.
That's well put. I hope you all had a chance to read this book, which I quite like. It's a bit of a medieval necromancy. This is sort of in keeping with how I view quantum theory. So today I want to tell you some more results along the general program of research, which takes as a starting point the idea that quantum states are states of knowledge, and need to figure out what it is in quantum mechanics that we can't understand as a consequence of our knowledge being restricted.
What's the necromancy?
it's a kind of wizardry, kind of magic that's disreputable. Necromancy. You having to do with death, that's right. Yeah. I guess black magic. Black magic, maybe.
I think you read the future in the guts of that animal. You expect the gods according to how they look, you say what's going to happen. This looks quite good.
So how's the talking about Ransko? Alright, so this is work I've done in collaboration with Steve Bartlett, University of Sydney, Terry Rudolph, Imperial College. So as John said, I'm going to tell you about Leavitt mechanics with a restriction on your knowledge. And that has some relevance to Bohr's response to EPR, so I'll talk briefly about that as well. And if you have any questions during the talk, please stop me. Now, I don't know why it's appearing in opposite order, but anyhow. So a lot of recent work in quantum foundations, from my perspective, gives evidence for the idea that maximal information about reality is incomplete information. And that this should form a foundational principle for quantum theory. So that in some future axiomatization of quantum theory, you might have this as one of your axioms, and then a couple more axioms in addition to that, which might tell you perhaps about reality. So this is a list of papers that I think, in my mind, argue in favor of this point of view, even if it wouldn't be agreed by the authors that this is what they do. But this is not enough. Just having this principle, as far as I can see, is not enough to get to quantum theory. So let me tell you a bit about some previous work I've done and what it suggests about how to proceed with the research program. So I'm going to have a couple slides about a paper that I spoke about, I guess it was 2003 at FBI, called In Defense of the Epistemic View of Quantum States, a Toy Theory. And the idea there is that you have a very simple system. You start with the following constraint. You imagine that for every system, there's an internal degree of freedom, and the number of questions you have answered about that internal degree of freedom is always equal to the number of questions you have unanswered, or less. This is in a state of maximal information, they're equal. And then you just use that principle and you start deriving consequences, and you get this elaborate formalism, which looks a lot like the stabilizer formalism of quantum theory, but is slightly different. And in it, you get analogs of all these different quantum phenomena, and I won't list them individually, but stuff like interference and non-commutativity, projection postulate, and lots of subtle features of the formalism all have nice analogs. And a lot of quantum information theoretic phenomena, like teleportation and no cloning, and key distribution, things like that, also appear in that toy theory. And so my conclusion from that is, well, if you look at the diversity and the strength of the analogies, that gives you evidence that, first of all, that this, there's something right about this principle, this idea that there's a restriction on how much we can know, and the idea that somehow you can get quantum theory from that. But also, given that in the toy theory, what's analogous to quantum states are states of incomplete knowledge, I take that as evidence for the idea that we should pursue interpretive programs wherein quantum states are states of incomplete knowledge. Now what's really interesting is to look at the phenomena that you don't reproduce, the quantum phenomena you don't reproduce in toy theory. So here's a short list. You have no violations of Bell inequalities. You have no Kaplan-Specker theorem, a few others. You have no exponential speedup. And so these are important because if you're going to try to complete the program, you need to focus on these and say, this is what we're missing. This is what the epistemic restriction didn't catch. And so this is the best clue for perhaps, you know, the way the reality has to be such that a restriction on information about that reality leads to quantum theory. So these are the kinds of things I'd like to focus on. The most important question that you're hoping to answer is what the knowledge is about, quantum states or states of knowledge. And so right now I don't have a good answer to that question, and so I'm sort of continuing on the process of trying to find more of these phenomena to look at. So in particular, it's interesting to look at a new regime in which you can apply an epistemic restriction. This toy theory I just told you about was such that the motional degree of freedom was completely possible. And so I had nothing like a spatial interference phenomenon, none of those features of quantum theory. So a natural question to ask is, can you do something similar to this other toy theory for the motional degree of freedom of quantum mechanics? And the answer is you can, and that's what this talk is about. And so at the end of the talk, I'm going to try to accumulate together the stuff that this toy theory didn't reproduce, and hopefully that will give us some clues.
So what do you mean by emotional?
Oh, I just mean the spatial degree of freedom, position and momentum. So it's a continuous variable as opposed to a discrete internal degree of freedom.
When you say classical, you mean without an epistemic restriction?
That's right. So in the old toy theory, I had these sort of little systems that had four internal states, and they floated around, and I assumed that their position was well-defined. So now I want a toy theory where I forget, in this new toy theory, there will be no internal degrees of freedom, but I'll be describing position and momentum, and I'll be assigning a restriction to how much you can know about position and momentum. So this is the alternative title for the talk, which is toy theory number two. And here's the outline. I'm going to start by talking about the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, and then I'm going to show you an analogous uncertainty principle that you can apply in a classical context. Then I'm going to define the theory which we're looking at, the toy theory, which I call epistemically restricted Liouville mechanics, and I'll tell you about some of its features. And then I'll look at Bohr's response to EPR, and then end with some discussion. Okay. So if you want to start with classical particle mechanics and apply a restriction on how much you can know, you need some sort of mathematical way of applying that restriction. And you can look to quantum theory to figure out a good way to do that. So quantum particle mechanics for n particles, or n particles in 1D, let's just call it n canonical degrees of freedom. You have your canonical commutation relations for the x and p operators. And now what I'm going to do is I'm going to introduce a vector, which I call z, which is just going to be all the canonical operators written in this order. And I'm going to use that in many of the slides to come. So I can abbreviate all these relations with this sort of relation. And when I do that, I find I need to define this matrix, which basically appears in the symplectic form in classical mechanics. And so bear in mind that sigma is going to pop up all over the place, and this is what it means. So now I can define expectation values of Hermitian operators in this way, and then I can define what's called the covariance matrix, which basically captures all the information about second order moments for the density operator. And it turns out that a general way of stating the Heisenberg uncertainty principle in quantum theory is that the covariance matrix for the density operator has to satisfy this matrix inequality, where sigma was defined on the last slide. So let me try to convince you of that in the context of just a single.
Sorry, can I?
Yes.
Gamma's purely real?
Gamma's real, that's right.
So how, what does it mean to have IH bar?
It means that the real and imaginary parts of this
should be. But gamma has no imaginary part. That's why I'm just puzzled by the notation.
Well, so suppose you take this and diagonalize it and set all of its eigenvalues to be positive.
Okay.
All right. Gamma need not be diagonal to begin with.
Okay.
Perhaps this the simple example will clarify.
Do you mean positive semi-definite?
Yes.
What is sigma?
So sigma is that symplectic, that matrix that appears in symplectic form here.
So a sigma line answer the identity.
That's right. So yeah, you can think of it as a multi-dimensional generalization of the Y polynomial.
So how do you get the polynomial? So gamma was real, but then you have an I and some sigma was real?
That's right, the sigma's real.
Yeah, so you have something real plus something imaginary,
and
that's supposed to be greater than zero.
Right, but these are matrices. And so the constraint greater than zero means that this resulting matrix has to be positive,
okay. Which
means that if I diagonalize it, all it's talking about is have to be positive. So when I diagonalize it, I get contributions from the gamma and the sigma.
Okay.
Other questions? So here's the simple example, which will take us back to more familiar territory. This is what the covariance matrix looks like for single canonical degree of freedom. So on the diagonal, you just have variances in position and momentum. And on the off diagonals, you have the cross correlations. And now, this condition that I wrote down, these are 2x2 matrices in this case. And it turns out it's equivalent to just setting the determinant of this matrix greater than 0. So you can calculate the determinant of this thing. So remember, the IH bar sigma is going to add terms on the diagonal, on the off diagonal. It's a 0 minus 1, 1, 0. So it's at, with the IH bar in front. So it's going to add terms here. Take the determinant and do some algebraic manipulation. You'll find you get this form here. And so this is just the what's called the Robertson-Schrodinger form of the Heisenberg-Schrodinger relation. And typically, we write it down this way. This has to be positive, therefore delta x delta p is greater than h bar over 2. So the generalization to more than a single canonical degree of freedom basically just allows that I can have interesting correlations between the positions and the momenta of the different particles. But ultimately, there's a restriction on the area or the volume in the multidimensional phase space about I can not know the state to the position and momenta of all these particles to within some volume. Okay. Now it turns out that I can introduce a similar kind of uncertainty principle in a classical context. So let me tell you about Lieben mechanics. So Lieben mechanics is just a fancy name for the theory of knowledge about classical particles. So in this case, if I have n canonical degrees of freedom, then I'm living in a 2n dimensional phase space. I'm now going to represent a point in that phase space by just a vector corresponding to the coordinate position and momenta of all the particles. And I'm going to denote a probability distribution over the phase space by mu of z. So remember that this z actually can be an arbitrary number of coordinates. And then I can define mean values for certain classical observables. So these are functions defined over the phase space. And to calculate the mean value, I just integrate with the probability distribution. So although it's possible classically to prepare systems, all of these properties are definite, in which case my knowledge is a delta distribution, and I just pick out f of some particular z. In certain scenarios, I might not have complete information about the classical system, so I'll describe it by probability distribution, and then my expectation for the value of that function will just be this expression here. And so now I can define a covariance matrix in terms of expectations of these classical observables, the zi, the different position and momenta. So it's exactly the same definition, except now, whereas previously I had expectation values given by trace of rho times the Guam operators, now I just have these expectation values given by integral of the classical observable times the probability distribution that represents my knowledge. So this covariance matrix tells me my information about position and the correlation between position and momenta and so forth. And in classical particle mechanics, the only constraint this covariance matrix has to satisfy is that it's positive. It turns out that because there's, I can have perfect information, there's no h-bar term in this inequality at all. But I could just make it ansatz. I could say, what if the universe were such that all observers living in it are constrained in how much they can know about physical systems? So there's some property of the universe that ensures that if you're an information gathering system, then you'll always be foiled in your attempts to find out too much about the particles around you. And in particular, the way that the universe is constructed, your information, these mu of z's, are never so narrow that they violate this inequality. So they always have to cover a volume in phase space, essentially, that's given by h bar.
And the sigma is exactly the same.
Exactly the same sigma, right? So remember, this covariance matrix was defined in terms of expectation values. All I've done is change those from quantum expectation values to classical expectation values. So now it's a function of a classical probability distribution rather than a density operator. But it's the same, but these matrices are the same dimensionality. For n particles, they'll be 2n by 2n matrices. Now, I could have made this different from h bar. I could have said, you know, imagine a universe where, you know, I have some lambda bar, which just describes the amount of uncertainty I have, and that lambda bar could be anything. I could set it to zero if I want. And in fact, that's the way I do it in the paper I'm writing out. But for some reason, I couldn't get PowerPoint to do a lambda bar. So it's going to be h bar. So it doesn't really matter. I mean, I might as well say, well, I'm going to consider that epistemically restricted Liouville theory, which happens to have h bar as the uncertainty. All right, and so now the rest, this is my starting point, this is the principle, and now I'm just going to start deriving. What are the consequences of this principle? You know, what does it mean for observers living in such a universe? Well, first of all, note that, you know, for a single canonical degree of freedom, you have exactly, you know, what we had in the quantum case. The covariance matrix has this form, where now all these expectation values are just classical expectation values. And this condition, again, becomes a condition on the determinant. It all works out to be exactly the same Heisenberg and Schrödinger relation, except now delta x and delta p really describe the variance of the probability distribution which I use to describe the position and momentum of the system. All right, so I'm going to start telling you consequences. I apologize for the busyness of the slides. First of all, to start deriving a few valid epistemic states, valid probability distributions, I'm going to go back to quantum theory for a moment. So let me remind you that in quantum theory, you can represent density operators using the Wigner representation, which is defined as follows. You just take trace of your density operator rho times a Hermitian operator AZ, which is just defined in this way. So for a single degree of freedom, Z is just x, comma, p. And I get, you know, e to the minus I, p, y, et cetera. And now it turns out you can ask, which of all the quantum states have positive Wigner function? And that question was answered by Hudson and extended by Soto and Claveri. And the answer is that only quantum states, the only quantum states with positive Wigner representation are the so-called Gaussian states. What that means is that states whose characteristic function is Gaussian. So I have to tell you what characteristic function is. It's the trace of the density operator times the Weyl operator, which is defined in this way, where again we have this symplectic form appearing. And so effectively, it turns out that the Wigner function is just the symplectic Fourier transform of this characteristic function. So when I say that the characteristic function is Gaussian, that ultimately entails that the Wigner function is Gaussian. So it turns out that the only Wigner functions that are positive are the ones that are Gaussian. And I'm sorry?
Wasn't it just the pure states, the only pure states that have positive Wigner functions are Gaussian?
No, this is true for mixed states as well. There's a really nice paper, a review article by Jens Eisert and Martin Klingo, and they describe the Gaussian states. in there in a very generic way. It's for mixed states for arbitrary number of particles.
Do you need to say that because, I mean, there's some other conference in Germany, and there was, I think there's a paper by Werner or so on, I think he used some example for something that is mixed state and then it's not Gaussian.
So it has a positive Wigner representation, but it's not Gaussian in this sense, that the characteristic function. Well, I'd be interested to see that.
Because for pure state, I mean, for sure.
Yes.
But I think he said it's quite useful.
Okay. Well, I take it back. I'll say for pure states, the only positive Wigner functions are Gaussian. For mixed states, I guess I don't know the answer, and perhaps it's not. But in any case, what it means for us is that these Wigner functions that are positive, well, let me put it in the following way. It turns out you can prove that if you have a quantum state that satisfies the quantum uncertainty principle, and all quantum states do satisfy that generalized Heisenberg uncertainty principle, then the associated Wigner function satisfies the classical uncertainty principle. Because I just rewrite the quantum expectation values in terms of expectation values with that Wigner function, which now look like classical expectation values. But only if those Wigner functions are positive can I think of them as probability distributions over classical phase space. So for the quantum states that have positive Wigner functions, I can take those Wigner functions as epistemic states, which I know will satisfy this classical uncertainty principle. So that's a set. So I've now identified a set of distributions which I know satisfy my epistemic constraint. So that's good. What do they look like? Well, coherent states are an example, and their Wigner functions are just Gaussians that are have the same width than x and p. Or I can have squeeze states, which have different widths, and I can rotate these squeeze states in the phase space. I can also have eigenstates of quadratures, like eigenstates of position or momentum, or some linear combination of position and momentum. And their Wigner functions are basically delta functions along one axis, like x, and flat along p, and I can rotate these as well. So all these sorts of probability distributions are valid epistemic states in theory. And in addition to them, for pairs of systems, I have a whole bunch of Gaussian states, a prominent example of which is the EPR state, which has a perfect correlation between position and momentum. And its Wigner function just looks like this. It says you have complete information about the relative position of particle 1 and 2, and you have complete information about the total momentum. Those two quantities commute. And you have no information about the total position or the relative momentum. So it satisfies the uncertainty principle. I'll be coming back to this in my discussion of the EPR argument. All right, so the cartoon of this is that, whereas in a standard view of mechanics, I can have sort of arbitrary distributions, including things that are arbitrarily narrow in x and p, and including all kinds of weird and wacky things, in this epistemically restricted Liouville theory, the only valid epistemic states are the ones that satisfy this constraint, and that eliminates some of the possibilities. So if you draw all of the probability distributions of the phase space, then the valid ones are in are a subset of that. And within that subset are the Wigner functions for Gaussian quantum states. It turns out that these aren't all of them, because my Heisenberg uncertainty principle, that constraint on the covariance matrix, really only constrains the second-order moments. So I can actually take something that has valid second-order moments and make the higher-order moments whatever I like, as long as it's a valid probability distribution, and it will also satisfy my epistemic constraint. So in addition to the Gaussians, I have top hat-like distributions, I have all kinds of different things lying in this space. Okay, now I want to tell you briefly about what sorts of measurements and transformations are allowed in this theory. So let me remind you of what the most general measurement in quantum theory looks like. It's a POVM, positive operator value measure. So it's a set of Hermitian operators that are positive and that sum up to identity. And the probability of getting outcome k in a measurement associated with this POVM is just given by the trace of the density operator times ek. So in standard Liouville mechanics, No restriction. You have something entirely analogous. The most general measurement possible is actually associated with what I call a set of indicator functions, and I denote by C sub k. So these are functions over your phase space. So remember, z is x1, v1, etc. And they tell me the probability of getting outcome k given that the classical state was z. And all I require is that these things be probabilities, right? So they have to be positive. And when I sum over k at every value of z, I get 1. Because I know that one of these outcomes has to occur. No matter what the classical state is, one of those different outcomes has to occur. So the probabilities for all the different k have to sum to 1. And of course, the probability of getting outcome k when I don't know the classical state z, but I only know the probability distribution, is just this expectation value here. So very, very analogous. Here's the cartoon version. Basically, one type of measurement is just carving up the phase space, right? So here I'm carving it up into bands with a very narrow position and broad in momentum. So that would be like a measurement of position alone, right? I find out nothing about momentum, find out everything about position. Or I could carve it up this way, and then I find out everything about momentum, nothing about position. Or I could carve it up in this very fine grain way, such that I discover both. Or I can have things that are probabilistic. So at a given state in the phase space, it's not determined which outcome is going to occur, because I have many overlapping indicator functions. It means there's a certain probability for multiple different outcomes. And there are arbitrarily complicated measurements as well. And now the question is, what does our epistemic restriction mean for measurements? Well, there's a way of figuring it out. There is a restriction on the measurements, and it basically comes from the fact that if I have a correlated epistemic state, so if I know two systems are correlated, like the classical version of the EPR state, and if I do a measurement on this one, then the indicator function that tells me the probability for a given outcome for all the different possible classical states actually tells me how I ought to update my state of information about the other system. Right? So if I get outcome one here, and I knew these two systems are perfectly correlated, and I know that the probability of state z, given that I got outcome one, was such and such, well, then I know that the probability of state z over there was such and such as well. So the indicator functions actually are constrained, because if they were too narrow, if I could find out too much about position and momentum, then I could actually measure half of one of these correlated states and collapse my state of information about the other one to something that violated the epistemic constraint. And that's not allowed. Therefore, these indicator functions, these overly narrow indicator functions, are not allowed as well. So it turns out you can prove, and it's actually not totally straightforward to prove this, but you can prove that the only valid indicator functions, so the only valid measurements, are the ones such that if I normalize that indicator function, then I get something that's a positive function, and which when I integrate over the phase space gives me 1, so is a distribution. That distribution has to satisfy the epistemic constraint. So all and only these indicator functions that satisfy this condition are allowed in theory. And so the cartoon version is that there are certain kinds of measurements that are prohibited, like the one that tells you both x and p at the same time. Whereas these sorts, which are basically, so these are all the different indicator functions that appear in measurement, you recognize these as being like those Gaussian states. These are sort of infinitely squeezed in x, and these are infinitely squeezed in p. And these ones are just like a collection of coherent states. They're all valid measurements.
Okay, is this assumption of galaxy acceleration, like you assume the measurement on one side doesn't disturb
Yes. position? Well, you can think of it this way. The theory I'm developing is although I'm calling it theory, I mean, it's classical mechanics. I'm just talking about a universe where the ontology is classical. So I'm not modifying the ontology at all. The ontology is what it is, what we know about classical mechanics. All I'm saying is, suppose within a universe with that ontology, I was restricted in how much I could know. And so, yes, because classical mechanics is local, therefore I can't assume that anything I do here affects something over there.
So you have to do special relativity because Newtonian mechanics is always non-local because it's a small potential which is non-local to find in the route. So you have to go to special relativity.
Yes. Or what I could do is just say, you know, there are ways of updating my information here such that, you know, there is no, you know, action at a distance gravitational potential that affects the particle over there. And for those sorts of ways of updating my information, you know, I know that if the integer function were too narrow, then my updated probability distribution would be too narrow. So I think I don't have to go to a relativistic domain to make sense of this. I don't need to say that there's no non-locality. I just need to say there's no non-locality induced by doing measurements. And there are ways of doing measurements that don't induce effects far away in classical mechanics.
Well, so if you want to have restore the notion of locality, you have to introduce a field concept. But then you can show that there's no field satisfying the Galilean relativity principle that has propagated the use of field.
Well, maybe we can talk about this at the end. So you can do the similar thing for transformations. Maybe it's not worth going into a lot of detail. In quantum mechanics, it's the completely positive maps. In Liouville mechanics, it's, I call them transfer functions. That should say transfer function. So a transfer function basically says, here's the probability that if the state was Z prime, it becomes Z at the end of the transformation. Now, it could be a one-to-one map, such that every Z prime gets mapped to a single Z. Or it could be that, you know, for a given Z prime, there are various different possible Z they could be mapped to with certain probabilities. But I know that if I integrate over all of the possible targets, I have to get one, because every state has to go somewhere. And I know these things are probabilities, so they have to be greater than zero. And so, you know, here's the cartoon. Every point in the phase space gets mapped to some other point, or maybe it gets mapped to some distribution over points. Maybe many of these things get mapped to the same point. These are all possible transfer functions that are allowed in Liouville mechanics. In epistemically restricted Liouville mechanics, we have to ask what constraints, if any, are applied to the transfer function. And here it's quite obvious. If I'm restricted in how much I can know about a system, then I obviously can't allow the transfer function that takes all the possible states in a classical phase space and maps them to one state. Because after I apply that map, I would then know everything there is to know, and that violates my constraint. So,
do you wish to conserve phase space volume also doing this?
Well, this classical uncertainty principle that I've adopted essentially ensures that phase space volumes are conserved. That's right. That's what it does. So, it's not that easy to prove. You have to start with finding a Jamolkowski isomorphism-like thing and do gate teleportation, all sorts of stuff. But in the end, you get this nice simple answer, which is that if you take your transfer function and you take its second argument and you do a momentum inversion, right? So remember, Z represents x1, p1, x2, p2. I change the sign of all the momenta, and then I normalize that thing. Well, that is a function of two arguments, and I can think of it as a probability distribution over two systems. So whatever my system was, duplicate it. Now think of that as a probability distribution over two of those systems. That probability distribution has to satisfy the epistemic constraint in order for this transfer function to be valid. So in the end, it's quite nice what the constraints on the measurements of the transfer function look like. In the cartoon, it means these kinds of maps are not allowed, but there's a variety of possibilities still left. Okay, so this is the summary of all that stuff I told you. Now what I'm going to do is just give you a couple more sort of facts about the theory, which are going to help me in the rest of the talk. Everything I've done here just is to show you that, look, it's really a consistent theory. It has a measurement theory. It's non-trivial. And These sorts of constraints actually make it, in its formalism, quite analogous to quantum theory.
Is that not wrong?
Yes. Yeah.
I had a sort of question that I've been waiting to put out. So you state that this is really a consistent theory.
maybe I shouldn't.
So, in quantum theory, for example, we have the usual measurement rules, the measurement postulates and stuff, and there's a measurement problem. But forget about the measurement. What you can at least do is show that there's a sort of consistency and that you can, you know, treat the measuring apparatus as a quantum system and model the interaction completely quantumly, and
hand surge.
Yeah.
You know, that one Neumann cut, you can always move it up.
I'm gonna show that. I'm going to show that in one particular example.
Is this obviously consistent in the same sense?
I don't think it's obviously consistent, but it turns out that it is. So I think the next two theorems I'm going to tell you about are going to sort of speak to that. And then in the EPR example, it'll become a bit clearer.
That C appears there.
Yes.
What is it?
It's momentum inversion. I didn't define it on the overhead. But it just means... So the Z represents X1, P1, X2, P2, so forth. The C operation represents changing the sign of all the momenta. The Z prime is just a different variable. It's just, yeah.
So there's some asymmetry also between X and P then, right? Because this will only allow the transformation, right?
Well,
where you only change P and not X and so
on. Here's maybe you can see why it has to be this way. Consider the transformation that does nothing. So it's delta function x1 minus x2, p1 minus p2. Just leaves things, or maybe I should say, you know, x to x prime and p to p prime. Okay. Now, what this tells me is I want to turn this into a valid epistemic state between two systems. Now, remember that the EPR state looked like this, p plus p prime. So that's the momentum inversion. I mean, I haven't given you the proof of this theorem, and I can show you where it arises in the proof. But intuitively, you sort of see that if I'm going to have to get a valid epistemic state from this transfer function, then that momentum inversion is going to happen.
But the upper is for one part of the system, but the lower is
for two. That's right. So this is why this, on the right-hand side of this expression, this means take one system, map its coordinate, you know, at initial time to its coordinate at a final time. Whereas on the left-hand side, I'm reinterpreting this as the coordinate for one physical system, and this is the coordinate for a different physical system. So it's just a way of saying, this is like the Jankowski isomorphism in quantum mechanics. For every operation on a single system, there's an associated state on a pair of systems. So this is the isomorphic state on the pair of systems to this operation on the single system. And the criterion is that this state has to satisfy the constraint.
Another question. Can you write the update rule, the transformation rule, rather, as a differential equation, integral equation? And if so, how different is it from standard Liouville equation?
Good question. Probably for the deterministic transfer functions, you can write it as a Liouville equation. For certain kinds of Markovian paths, then probably you can have some sort of open system dynamics, master equation type approach as well, but I haven't really looked into it. I should probably continue if I'm going to get to Bohr's response to EPR. So here's a couple of important theorems. So, you know, remember Z represents the canonical coordinates. Now, imagine a change of canonical coordinates to some new coordinates where it's a symplectic transformation of a coordinate. So symplectic transformations keep me within the canonical coordinates. And the theorem is that if the covariance matrix defined with respect to one choice of canonical coordinates satisfies the inequality, then it also satisfies the inequality with respect to all choices of canonical coordinates. So if I look at the covariance matrix defined in terms of the z primes instead of in terms of the z's, that if the gamma satisfies the inequality, then so do the gamma primes. So in particular, what this means is, I'll skip the proof because unless anybody really doesn't believe it. One of the consequences of this is that Hamiltonian evolution, being a canonical transformation, preserves the inequality being satisfied. So if I start with some valid epistemic state, then under any Hamiltonian evolution, I can't get to something which is narrower in the phase space, which is just Liouville stable. Yes?
The proof that other thing has to depend on the structure of sigma, I would assume, right?
Yes.
So how much freedom is there in choosing? I mean, you're motivated to choose sigma because you're trying to talk quantum mechanics, but if I just wanted something restricted in Liouville space, I could do lots of things, presumably.
Well, actually, the sigma appears if you do Hamiltonian mechanics. you know, long before quantum mechanics came around, the Hamiltonian mechanics uses that matrix. It's a symplectic vector space.
Oh, but
in that sense, I don't see what the alternatives are.
Well,
maybe I'm just not familiar with
that. What we know in Liouville is that gamma is positive, and you're adding this thing in by hand.
Yes.
So.
Ah. Oh, I see.
You're adding something else by it. So my question is
yep.
this theorem going to very tightly restrict that something else you can add in? My guess is.
What you're going to want is if you want to entertain a different epistemic restriction, then you're going to want it to have the same feature that under symplectic transformations, the form of that restriction doesn't change.
Yeah, and that's
why I see. Well, I'm not sure the inequality in that particular form. I can imagine other kinds of restrictions, but they don't involve just changing sigma. They're sort of more radical. Like instead of looking at a covariance matrix, which gives me second order moments for this distribution, I could look at things like entropic quantities. So there are entropic uncertainty principles in quantum mechanics. I can introduce classical versions of those. And I think that would lead to something quite different. Okay. All right, second theorem, and this will be important for response PPR. So the classical uncertainty principle that I defined is satisfied by a distribution mu over phase space if and only if it's satisfied for the marginal of mu on any canonical subspace. So what I mean by that is, if I have some collection of particles, if I look at any individual particle, any collection of those particles, if I look at the relative coordinates between particles, the collective coordinates, any canonical subsystem, the epistemic constraint will have to be satisfied for the marginal on that subsystem as well. And this is an if and only if. So again, I'm not going to go through the proof. It just involves this one algebraic identity. That's a non-trivial step.
So
yes?
N could be any dimension.
That's right.
Even one dimension.
Well, it has to be a phase space, so it has to be an X and a P. And this is the other half of the proof, which uses Williamson's theorem. But here's the moral of the story. What it says is that whatever the minimum uncertainty is for any one of the subsystems, I can move that minimum uncertainty around. But I can never make that minimum uncertainty less. So if I have a system remember that H bar could really be lambda bar, and it could vary for different subsystems. I could have different certainties. So if one of those subsystems has a very small lambda bar, then I could make any subsystem have that same small uncertainty by just doing some Hamiltonian evolution. But if there's some minimum uncertainty for all the subsystems initially, and then the composite satisfies the epistemic restriction for that minimum uncertainty, and then any other subsystem must satisfy that restriction as well. And so what it means is that there's no way of concentrating my certainty. So if I just tell you, volumes in phase space are preserved, then you might still think, here I have a certain area in phase space, and here I have that same area in phase space, it's just distributed differently. But that's not the case. You cannot shunt all of your uncertainty into one of the subsystems and be left very certain about one of the subsystems. Your uncertainty about a given subsystem at any time is only as good as your the best initial uncertainty, so whatever system you have the most information about. Okay, so the slogan is the minimal uncertainty can be moved around, but can't be decreased. OK, so now I'm ready to tell you a bit about Bohr's response to PPR. So it turns out if you read Bohr's reply, and actually in the last couple of weeks I've been poring over it, trying to decipher what this great man could possibly have meant in various passages. I think there's some good physics in there. But what you'll notice if you read it is that he starts it off, and he's not even talking about the PPR experiment. He's talking about a much simpler experiment, where effectively he's just showing the consistency of the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. So he's really responding to the following kind of challenge that somebody could pose to the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, and perhaps Einstein did pose this very challenge. He certainly posed challenges like it, which is the following. Suppose I measure the position of a particle by passing it through a slit, and then I try to also learn its final momentum in the following way. Well, let's say I know its initial momentum before it goes through the slit, and then I just I keep track of how much momentum has been imparted to the slit. And so by applying conservation momentum, I can find out how much momentum particle has after it comes out of the slit. But I also know it's, you know, it's just come through the slit. Therefore, I know its position and its momentum simultaneously. So what does Bohr say about this? So the first thing he does is he makes it clear that if you're imagining this possibility of determining the position and the momentum of the particle relative to something else, it's always, these quantities are always relative. So if you're interested in, for instance, you know, predicting what's going to happen in a two-slit experiment, then you'd better know these positions of momentum relative to this part of the apparatus, because, you know, these are the predictions you want to make. And so in that case, if you want to know the position of this particle relative to this part of the apparatus, it better be that this is all fixed rigidly together. But then the problem is that if you've got it fixed like this, then you've basically said that you're not allowing yourself to measure the momentum imparted to this diaphragm, because it's fixed to the support in your lab. So what you really have to do if you're serious about measuring the momentum exchanged with the diaphragm is to do a setup like this, where you put the diaphragm on some springs attached to the support such that you can see how much it recoils. So here's the idea. You measure the initial momentum of the diaphragm. You measure the final momentum of the diaphragm after the particle's passed through. Before the particle passes through, you measure its momentum, so you know the initial momentum of the particle. By momentum conservation, you infer the final momentum of the particle. And now it might seem that in this way you've learnt both the final momentum of the particle and its final position, because it came through the slit. But in fact, all you've really learnt is the relative position between the particle and the diaphragm, right? Because you know it's right in the center of the diaphragm because it came through the slit. But maybe you don't know where the diaphragm is now. If you want to know the position of the particle relative to the frame, then you need to know the position of the diaphragm. But now Bohr says, well, now that you've done this to the slit, you've considered it on springs, you have to consider it as a system to which the Heisenberg uncertainty principle applies. And so now, given that you measured its final momentum, you can't possibly know its final position, because Heisenberg's uncertainty principle says you can't. And so you don't know the final position of the diaphragm, you can't infer the final position of the particle, so you can't know both the final momentum and the final position of the particle. That is my synopsis of what Bohr says. There's some subtleties in what he says, because he's often talking about the disturbances to the frames. But effectively, this is it. And now what you'll notice is, especially if you read this paper, is that he doesn't talk about Hilbert space. He doesn't talk about vectors in Hilbert space or wave functions. Bohr always talks about positions and momenta as if there was a classical reality there. So you can read, he says things like, in fact, even if we knew the position of the diaphragm relative to the space frame before the first measurement of its momentum, and even though the position at the last measurement can be accurately fixed, we lose, blah, 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 the knowledge of its position when the particle passes through the slit. He's talking as if these things have positions and momenta, and we're losing knowledge of those things. What he's saying is exactly consistent with the epistemically restricted Liouville theory I've told you about. I mean, his language basically is a nice description of exactly how you would analyze this experiment in that theory. So that's interesting, I thought. But what's also nice is now you can essentially generalize Bohr's argument. Bohr was considering this one particular example with the slit, but you could say, well, okay, Bohr, you've responded to that example, but I've got, you know, three more examples waiting, and I've got more to come. But those general theorems I showed you earlier show that within the context of this epistemically restricted Liouville mechanics, you can never beat the uncertainty principle. The reason is basically what I said before. You can move your minimal uncertainty around, but you can't decrease it. So if you had a system and a diaphragm such that you knew everything about the position and momentum of the diaphragm, then yes, you could come to know everything about the position and momentum of the particle. But if you assume that the diaphragm as well satisfies your uncertainty principle for some minimum uncertainty h bar, then there's no way to shunt that uncertainty into some other systems and come to know the position and momentum of the particle definitely. And this is a general argument for any experimental setup. It just relies on assuming that this principle really does apply to everything. And if it applies to anything, it has to apply to everything. Because if I say, oh, I want my uncertainty principle to apply to this subsystem, but not to this one, well, there's always some transformation that'll take that certainty and bring it onto your system. So if you want the uncertainty principle to hold for anything, you've got to assume it for everything. OK, running out of time. But let's go on now to Bohr's response to the actual EPR experiment. So I assume I don't have to go into great detail about the EPR experiment. Most of you are probably familiar with it. You prepare a pair of particles in a maximally entangled state, perfectly correlated in position and momentum, send them off to Alice and Bob. Alice then measures either position or momentum on her particle and immediately infers the position or the momentum of Bob's particle. And given that if you can infer something about this particle without in any way disturbing it, and the space-like separation, in this case, together with the assumption of locality, ensures that you're not disturbing it, then there must be a physical element of reality associated with that. And so by this argument, you infer that this particle has to have both position and momentum. That's Einstein's argument. This, bear in mind, this is after Einstein had failed to challenge the correctness of quantum mechanics. At first, Einstein was trying to come up with ways of beating the uncertainty principle and learning the position and momentum simultaneously. Now he's given up that task. He's saying, yeah, we can't learn the position and momentum, but the fact that I can come to know either in a way that doesn't disturb the system tells me that they both have to exist. Now, there's an exact analog of this experiment in this epistemically restricted Liouville theory, because the Wigner representation of the EPR state, as I mentioned, is positive. So this corresponds to knowing precisely what the distance between the two particles is and precisely what the total momentum is. And so what it means is that initially, if you look at the marginal distribution over the second system, it's completely flat. I know nothing about Q2 or P2. Now, if on one of the particles you measure position, then by virtue of this correlation, you update your information about the other particle such that you know its position at the end. You still know nothing about its momentum, but you know its position. Whereas if you did the measurement of momentum on the first system, then you would learn what the momentum of the second particle is by virtue of the fact that it's perfectly anticorrelated with the momentum of your particle. So note that you haven't disturbed the distant system. There could be a point in phase space here, the intersection between this line and this line. So that's the state of the second system. Initially, you don't know what it is, but you just update your information in one of two ways. Either I find out exactly where it is in position, or I find exactly where it is in momentum, but not both. But the point is that in this theory, it certainly has both the position and momentum. So that is an element of reality. So this sort of theory is likely what EPR were conceiving of as the way one ought to interpret the EPR experiment, perhaps. I think that's likely. Now, given how close Bohr's discussion was to the discussion you would give of any experiment within this restricted Liouville theory, you might say, well, Bohr must have seen this. He must have seen that this is precisely a good way of describing the EPR experiment. And so let's look at what he said about it. And my synopsis of everything he says about it is this. If you learn x1, the position of particle 1, you disturb its momentum. That's also part of this epistemically restricted Liouville mechanics. If you learn position, you disturb momentum. Therefore, if you disturb momentum particle 1, it's no longer perfectly correlated with momentum particle 2. So a subsequent measurement of the momentum of particle 1 doesn't allow you to infer anything about particle 2. And this is sort of textual evidence for the notion that this is what he believes. But let me skip it and just say, all he's really saying here is, look, you can't come to know both the position of particle 2 and the momentum of particle 2. As far as I can tell, that's all his argument establishes. He's just giving another defense of the uncertainty principle, that if you try to measure the position of particle 1, you disturb its momentum. Now you can measure its momentum after you've done that, but that momentum now tells you nothing about the momentum of the other particle. So you can't infer both the other particle's position and momentum at the same time. But Einstein never claimed that you could. At this point, Einstein had given up on trying to prove that the uncertainty principle was wrong. So this seems a bit odd as a response to Einstein, to show that you can't know both the position and momentum of the second particle simultaneously. So let's go a bit deeper and into Bohr's response. Maybe we can see what's going on. So I showed you this quote earlier, where it's very clear that he's talking about the position of the diaphragm, the momentum of the diaphragm, the knowledge of the position of the diaphragm, language that seems appropriate for believing that there's a classical reality and that quantum mechanics describes our knowledge of it. And now I'll look at a quote that appears somewhere near the end of the paper. Just in this last respect, it doesn't matter what he was talking about just previously. Any comparison between quantum mechanics and ordinary statistical mechanics, and that's essentially what this restricted Liouville theory is, it's a kind of statistical mechanics, however useful it may be for the formal presentation of the theory, is essentially irrelevant. Indeed, we have in each experimental arrangement suited for the study of proper quantum phenomena not merely to do with an ignorance of the value of certain physical quantities, but with the impossibility of defining these quantities in an unambiguous way. So that seems to me to be very much at odds with the kind of language he's been using. Here he's talking about knowing the position, knowing the momentum. Now he says, oh, you shouldn't talk about merely having ignorance of the value of a physical quantity. It has to do with these quantities not being well defined. So my conclusion from all this is that Bohr is an operationalist, a strict operationalist. He believes that two quantities can be jointly well-defined only if they can be jointly measured. If he didn't believe this, then why, from the impossibility of two quantities being jointly measured, would he infer the impossibility of their being jointly well-defined, as opposed to merely inferring the impossibility of their being jointly known? If I can't jointly measure them, then I can't jointly know them. That's clear. But Bohr wants to infer more. Can't jointly measure them, therefore they're not jointly well-defined. And I suspect Einstein would deny that, because Einstein is not an operationalist. He could say things are well-defined despite my not being able to measure them jointly. My analysis is that none of Bohr's arguments are at odds with the hidden variable interpretation of the EPR experiment. In fact, they resonate really nicely with such interpretation, the one I provided here. All the stuff he says in that about positions and disturbances to the frame, all of that really verbatim is what you would predict, what you would say about that experiment in the context of this restricted Liouville theory. So it really, it's almost like reading, it's almost as if Bohr thought that quantum mechanics was this epistemically restricted Liouville theory, except that Bohr was not a realist. In my opinion, Bohr's operationalism is assumed in his analysis of the EPR experiment, and this analysis provides no new argument for this operationalism, because as I showed you, the analysis is perfectly consistent with the hidden variable theory. All right, I'm at the end, so let me just make a few points of discussion, and then I'll open it up for questions. You can ask in this restricted Liouville mechanics, what sorts of phenomena do you get, and you can make lists of them. And there's a lot of things that are like quantum theory. There's a lot of work that's been done on positive Wigner functions, these gas and states, and all the aspects of quantum information theory that exist within the context of gas and states. And I expect most of those aspects to exist in this theory as well. I hope we're talking a bit earlier about different epistemic restrictions. I'm hoping that if you restrict more than just the second order moments, that actually you can find a theory which restricts you right down to the gas and quantum states. So your toy theory would actually be a subset of quantum mechanics. That would be quite nice. It would be saying this subset of quantum mechanics can be derived from an epistemic restriction on top of classical mechanics. And then, of course, as I said in the beginning, the really interesting stuff is what's not reproduced by these theories. So again, we don't have non-locality, we don't have contextuality, we have no speed up in computation. There's lots of others. And an interesting question that I've been thinking a lot about recently is whether quantization of energy and angular momentum are phenomena that you can explain in the context of one of these theories or not. The jury's still out on that one. Okay, and now let me just add with some sort of tantalizing speculations. Let's just take a minute. Consider the classical argument for the stability of the atom. So the standard argument is the electron will spiral into the nucleus, radiate all its energy away, and it can't be stable for that reason. But hang on a sec, if it spirals into the nucleus, at the end of that decay, I would know the relative position of nucleus and electron and the relative momentum of the nucleus and electron. That's inconsistent with my principle, my epistemic restriction. How can this be? Well, the conclusion must be that if you assume that the classical uncertainty principle is satisfied for particles, then for consistency, you have to demand that it's satisfied for the electromagnetic field as well. What happened in that classical argument for the decay of the atom is that you said, look, there's some uncertainty about the atom, but I know everything about the field. Basically, I can come to know that the atom has collapsed, and then all that uncertainty gets carried away by the field. If instead I assume I don't want that to happen, I want the uncertainty principle to continue to hold for the atom, I have to imagine that initially it holds for the field as well. So now I have an epistemic restriction on the fields as well, which means that the quantum vacuum state is not vacuum. It's not nothing. It represents a probability distribution over classical electromagnetic fields whose mean happens to be on zero field, but which has a variance and which represents a number of possibilities. And if you know, if you've ever heard of stochastic electrodynamics, you'll immediately start thinking this sounds a lot like zero-point fluctuations. And that's exactly what it is. So you can go off and read all sorts of previous work on stochastic electrodynamics, and you'll find that they've reproduced a whole bunch of interesting quantum features, things that are very different from the kind of quantum information theoretic phenomena I've been focusing on in my work. Things like Bland shift, the Casimir effect, the Unruh effect, stability of atomic ground states and other features of atomic ground states, and so on. I have a summer student where we worked a bit on explaining a few other quantum phenomena by assuming that the vacuum is not empty, and you can get things like interaction free measurement, quantum eraser, and so forth. And the big difference between the theory I envisage exploring and the one that's been explored previously in the literature is that what we see now is that for consistency, I need to assume the restriction for both the particles and the field. Otherwise, I can't keep the uncertainty. So in stochastic electrodynamics, they assume zero-point fluctuation for the field, but they assume nothing about the particle. They assume you can have complete information about the particles. That's not consistent. The theory I was telling you about was just for particles, and that's not consistent either. So you have to assume the restriction for both the particles and the fields and see where it leads you. So really, what I would like to be studying is the epistemically restricted electrodynamics of fields and particles. And then once you're there, you start asking, what about gravity? What about 5-4 field theories? We heard a talk by Bob Holdham on that. And so there's lots of other interesting systems to which you can try to apply these constraints and see what sorts of quantum phenomena you can derive. I'll stop there. Yes?
So what can you say about the spectrum of the hydrogen atom?
Well, on one of my slides, I had as a sort of one of the opening questions whether quantization, energy quantization, is something that you can hope to explain with one of these epistemic restrictions. And as I said, I don't know the answer to that. I sort of have reasons for and against the idea that you could explain it. So against the idea that you could hope to explain energy quantization is the fact that in theories like Nelson's mechanics, which are a lot like this, where you have a probability distribution over a classical phase space, it turns out that you don't have something that's equivalent to quantum theory unless you add in what is effectively Bohr's quantization rule. So there's issues about the single valueness of the phase field, and what it ultimately boiled down to is that Nelson has to assume a quantization rule to get to derive the Schrodinger equation. And so from that perspective, it seems like that's something that Nelson had to add. Therefore, you probably won't get it out of the epistemic restriction by itself. On the other hand, when I look at these toy theories that involve vacuum substructure, I find that I can reproduce interference phenomena. And naively, I always thought that quantization had something to do with interference. So the fact that I can reproduce certain interference phenomena leads me to think, well, maybe I can reproduce quantization phenomena as well. Anyways, but I don't know. Certainly, the stochastic electrodynamics people have not derived the spectra of these. Yes?
When you say that you don't have knowledge of locality,
yeah.
Do you mean that you can't explain the correlation that we see, or do you mean that you can explain but in a local way?
No, I mean that this theory I'm discussing is distinct from quantum theory. And one of the senses in which it's deficient is that whereas there are correlations that violate the bounding qualities in quantum theory, there are no such correlations in this theory. So as a theory of the world, it's bad because it's not empirically adequate.
Is that because you have limited measurements, or because you is there a direct correspondence in measurements that violate bounding qualities that because you get different results?
Well, there's a few ways of answering this. So first of all, ultimately, you know, if you ask why, one answer I could give you is because underlying all this is just classical mechanics. And classical mechanics is local. Modulo, if you have, you know, fields that are do have actually a distance. But I think more, I think I can answer your question a bit better, which is if you take the EPR state in quantum theory and ask, can I get proof of non-locality from the EPR state? The answer is you can, but you can't do it with measurements of quadratures.
Right.
You have to go to something like parity measurements. Now, if you look at the Wigner representation of the measurement operators, you find that those parity measurements have negative Wigner representations, and therefore there's no analog of them in this theory. I think that's... Yeah.
So you have no analog of entanglement, basically.
Well, you do have an analog of entanglement. It's just that you realize that sort of the phenomena we associate with entanglement can be divided into two categories. You know, one category is things like non-locality, violations of bounding qualities. The other category are things like useful for dense coding, useful for key distribution, etc. And all those things are true in this theory. You can do that, right? So if I'm living in a universe where there's only so much I can find out about a system, then if the eavesdropper comes in and starts measuring information about it, the eavesdropper disturbs it. And Alice and Bob can use that to do key distribution. Yes?
Yeah, going back, not to the spectra of the hydrogen atom, but not to spectrum, the argument that you alluded to about the uncertainty principle preventing the collapse of the hydrogen atom is a nice intuitive argument, but it's actually flawed because you can get around it, say, by in conventional quantum mechanics, by having a small probability that the electron is in the moon, as well as going close to the nucleus. This is true. Because that will make the average uncertainty of the...
But if there's a small probability... Just trying to understand that,
the standard argument is that if the particle collapses into the nucleus, delta x becomes very, very small. Okay, so delta p has to get huge. But you can let, you know, with high probability, and this is conventional quantum mechanics, the wave function get very close to the nucleus, and with a certain problem, you know, very, very, put a little blip of your wave function on the moon. Okay, that can make delta x very big.
So my question to you is, is it clear that if that is your wave function?
No, that's not your wave function, let me finish. Okay, but the conventional argument, the hydrogen Hamiltonian is bounded below, based on that, is flawed. Maybe you can even do it for the hydrogen atom, but not for larger atoms. But you can get around this by using instead a Sobolev inequality in conventional quantum mechanics. And so my question is, does your theory incorporate the possibility of Sobolev inequality replacing the Heisenberg uncertainty principle?
I don't know what the Sobolev inequality is.
It relates kinetic energy to...
So I think that this theory is just a stepping stone. That what I would really like is a theory that better captured the kind of uncertainty we have in quantum theory. Even the Heisenberg uncertainty principle doesn't really capture the constraints on what we can know in quantum theory, because it only constrains...
That's exactly what I said.
Right.
That for war particles, you actually do better using Sobolev inequalities to bound the kinetic energy.
I agree with that. That this is not, you know, the be-all and end-all of bounds on our information. What I don't quite understand about your argument, but you know, perhaps you're totally right, is whether it really bears, whether it saves you from this classical argument of clock to the atoms. I don't know about that. But I agree that, yeah, you have better uncertainty principles out there. And what I would like to do is take an uncertainty principle that really characterizes quantum theory and turn it into a classical analog and then develop a theory based on that. And as I speculated near the end, what I'm hoping is that when I take this more powerful uncertainty principle, I'll restrict myself from the set of all possible Einstein states beyond the ones I have in this theory to the set of Gaussian states, so that I'll get a subset of quantum mechanics. So, we already know that the Gaussian states have Wigner, positive Wigner functions, and therefore admit the hidden variable theory. But what this would do is show that hidden variable theory can be derived axiomatically from a principle that basically is a classical uncertainty principle. And basically, so I think that would be nice to have that derivation. So I'd be very interested to hear if you have any ideas on how to turn better quantum uncertainty principle into classical uncertainty principle.
So if you take states and violate valid inequalities, then presumably you could prove that the Wigner representation has to be negative somewhere. So
you've proved that the Wigner representation of either the states or the measurements you use have to be negative. But the Wigner representation of the state can be completely positive, and you still have a violation of Bell inequality.
So if you model everything with a measurement equivalent, something has to be negative.
That's right, either the measurements or the states. Yeah.
So if you want to keep with the topology of X and B, then epistemic view is ruled out of that case, right? So you have to. I mean, what would be your way out of this? Because, in an epistemic view, you should have always positive Wigner functions, right?
So the way out is that what I'm doing here is not reproducing all the predictions of quantum theory. That wasn't my objective.
No,
I agree. I mean, I haven't done that.
I will say that now, let's try to make the next step.
Oh, so yeah, how do you make
the next step? Maybe the ontology is wrong.
Right.
Go to different ontology.
So my best guess is that things like non-locality and contextuality actually are teaching us that the notion that I can have intrinsic properties for some system that gets spit out of the preparation device, and that then gets measured by the measurement device, that framework is wrong to think about systems having intrinsic properties. And within that framework, we won't be able to derive quantum theory in this epistemic program. My best guess is that what you have to do is imagine that the universe, that the only properties you can speak of are relations among things in the universe. And I don't know how to make that rigorous. My best guess is that the ontology is radically relational. And that somehow will get you non-locality and contextuality within an epistemic view. But I don't think I can do much better than that to answer your question. Sure.
So about this idea of further restrictions. In quantum mechanics, we start with the Hilbert space structure, and that implies the Hilbert uncertainty principle.
Yes.
Can you take that as an axiom for your epistemic restriction?
The classical version of it, yeah.
And then, presumably, the Hilbert uncertainty principle isn't the only moment inequality implied by Hilbert space.
Right.
There could be some hierarchy of moment inequalities.
Right. And what I would really like is a principle that somehow captures all that hierarchy in a simple analytic form, maybe an entropic uncertainty principle, something like that. And then get a classical version of that.
You said that you can do secure key distribution.
So let me add my caveat, which is that anytime you really want to prove secure key distribution, you have to do a whole lot of work. So maybe my caveat is you have the ingredients for doing key distribution, which is the fact that any information gain leads to a disturbance.
So when you derive possible transformations, you have this kind of Bernoulli assumption.
Yes.
Built in. And of course, the fact that the theory is local is a thing that means that you can't actually keep the predictions of quantum theory.
Right.
Couldn't you weaken that assumption? So you could not assume locality of the hidden variable, but still insist on locality, like signal locality, because that would be a different constraint on that derivation. other things still go through in the same way. So, for example, in Europe, it's a principle for the human fly, you know, certain equilibrium distribution, if we delight at our distributions. So it's conceivable that in that context, you might actually get something which is, you know, like Nelson's mechanics or Bohm's theory or something like that, so, which actually could agree with your opinion. And it's still mostly in keeping with the spirit of what you're doing. It was complete epistemic states, which is dropping this locality.
Perhaps what I find difficult when trying to conceive theories like that is in what sense you have a notion of subsystem left over when you allow for these non-local interactions.
Yeah.
I mean, this relies heavily on a notion of subsystem. But if I don't know, perhaps you forget about the notion of subsystem and develop a theory along the lines of what John's developed. Where you do have no signaling, but not locality. And then I guess the question would become, what constrains you to have only that much non-locality as quantum theory has, as opposed to more?
Typically, you have access to that sort of in your restriction.
Oh, you think that an epistemic restriction might effectively restrict the amount of non-locality as well?
It's conceivable that restriction will end up giving you quantum theory rather than something more general like Johnson did.
But wouldn't the wing function be negative no matter what assumption made of locality or non-locality as an environment? Isn't that so? Would that actually be different?
Well, when you're starting with this classical theory imposing an epistemic restriction, there are no Wigner functions. There are no quantum states, and therefore no Wigner functions of those states. You just have valid probability distributions. In this sort of theory, you would have you'd have these non-signaling but superluminal causation, I don't see. It's just not obvious to me how the epistemic constraint will restrict the strength of that non-locality. Maybe have some insight into that.
I guess I actually like your idea better, which is you need to be more radical.
Maybe I should add that. I mean, Terry Rudolph is more sympathetic with the idea that you're describing, and I think he spent a fair bit of time trying to come up with a simple model for sort of 2-qubit Bellian body violations involving some kind of signaling. And so far, he hasn't been successful.
I mean, an epistemic constraint could be extreme non-locality. If you have these superposing correlations, perfect correlations in all the different measurement choices, you measure something here. And it turns out you have to allow that you can compare a state which has definite values for all the different options over here. So in that theory, there's a sort of non-commutativity of observables in the sense that
measure the load
force, if you can prepare systems
that are
definite.
Sorry, that's not. It's not. By the way, did I answer your earlier question about measurement theory in a roundabout sort of way?
I was thinking about that, probably, but I'm not sure yet.
Okay.
Do you think it might be in relation to the work that was done on fishery information? I think by Frieden, who, by imposing an epistemic constraint on maximizing fishery information, derived equations like the Schrödinger equation.
No, I haven't looked into that. I should. I think there's been a number of research programs along those lines, Nelson being one, but I guess I should become familiar with all of them.
So, since your dynamics forced you to go to an epistemic electromagnetic theory,
yes.
The same argument could apply to other forces as well. So, what's epistemic?
Infinity, continuous variables, and beyond.
Right. So, what's epistemic gravity?
Well, that's a good question.
Well, gravity is already epistemic, isn't it?
Well, what would be interesting is to formulate gravity in a way that it appears like a field theory. I don't know much about gravity, but if you take an approximation wherein you think of the metric as a field, then I think it would be relatively straightforward to apply an epistemic constraint to it and see what kind of predictions you get. But to really do it properly, I don't know. Does anybody here know in what sense gravity can be formulated in terms of a symplectic vector space?
It cannot be.
One
Einstein.
Well, then there's a problem.
You can still consider a distribution.
That's quite an interesting question.
Yes.
You can consider a density of metrics somehow, as the dynamical equation of some kind of.
You can certainly pursue sort of more broad program, you know, talking about a classical theory of gravity about which you have uncertainty. I agree. But the particular mathematical formalism I've developed here can easily be extended from particle mechanics to electrodynamics because electrodynamics also has the structure of symplectic vector space. But it cannot be so easily extended to gravity, I presume.
But the issue there is just that you cannot have closed Hamiltonian curves and so on. If you exclude those in a global Hamiltonian space, then you have a Hamiltonian form of in that context. If you rule out time machines, you're fine.
Okay. I'm happy to rule out time machines.
So, but for electrodynamics, to what extent were you forced on a particular form of the epistemic theory, and to what extent was it just a choice? You were forced to go to some kind of epistemic electrodynamics, but were you forced to a particular form of that, or was it undetermined and you had to make some kind of choice?
It's a good question. It seemed to me the simplest thing to do would be, you know, whatever epistemic restriction you're using for this symplectic vector space, you should use the same epistemic restriction for the other. Just don't introduce a new kind of epistemic restriction.
But in general, there has to be some kind of compatibility. If it was just an arbitrary different epistemic restriction,
right,
it would let you circumvent.
Yeah, I mean, if you know, one of the epistemic restrictions constrained the higher order moments and the other didn't, then effectively there would be no subsystem for which the higher order moments were constrained because I could always shut my certainty around. So yeah, you do want to have consistency in the nature of the restriction you apply. I don't know if there are complications regarding how to extend this to electrodynamics because I haven't gotten around to it. But I presume that there might be some technical difficulties, but conceptually it seems straightforward. Just be the electric and magnetic field is your phase space for all the modes.
So, have you thought about just thermodynamics? There you have a probability distribution of phase space. Does it fit into this program? Or would it satisfy the uncertain principles? There you can have different temperatures, and you would have different energy constant surfaces, and the uniform measure on that or whatever.
So I suspect that you could formulate thermodynamics within this theory because knowledge of macroscopic observables generally doesn't contradict the epistemic constraint. So, knowing what the temperature is doesn't conflict with my constraint.
Yeah, it would be interesting to see if it actually fits into thermodynamics.
What about
thermodynamic laws? Maybe this fits inside the I'm asking this question because if you go along the environmental group, you see that quantum theory nicely fits as an equilibrium theory between quantum distributions. It's most natural for us as an equilibrium distribution. So it seems similar.
Yeah. I don't know that. Sure.
Since we were on gravity, you have a list of. You had these papers by the rest people who reproduce using this kind of idea, reproduce Casimir effect and all kinds of things. Just because of the current gravity, should we mention that all of these violate the equivalence principle? Because
one of the motivations why I'm doing this experiment, is to see the origin of inertia, the very notion why it was important to me. It's nice to have inertia, that we do quickly. So, although it really produces some of the quantum effects, it doesn't necessarily.
See, you're referring to the Tesh-related argument for how inertia can arise in stochastic vector dynamics. So I find it awkward to be defending them, but because I can't really attest to whether that idea makes sense. But let me try to defend them. I think they would respond that you need to also rethink gravity, and basically gravity becomes an effective force mediated by electromagnetism. So it's like a van der Waals force. And within that context, maybe it's still a consistent theory.
No, my point is that that very notion by Isaac Willis, that therefore it goes to the Einstein theory, it could be a different theory.
Uh-huh.
Which is smart.
So you're saying you can show that there's no explanation of inertia of that sort can be consistent with the prediction?
Not with Einstein.
Okay, and I'd be interested to hear more. Any more questions?